Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, Greece enters what one analyst calls uncharted territory. The U.S. gets a big win in soccer. A beloved comedy puppet team is returning.
The Muppets are silliness and love, all wrapped up in music and very, very colorful personalities.
And looking back at the short life of singer Amy Winehouse, coming up right here on The Voice of America. The Greek voters have taken a stand and said no to the European Union bailout plan. VOA's Victor Beatty is following that story and joins me here in the studio. Victor, what's going on?
Well, Susan, hours after Greek voters overwhelmingly rejected further austerity measures demanded by its creditors, the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, resigned early Monday after he was made aware of a certain preference by some members of the Eurozone for his absence from meetings of finance ministers. Varoufakis has often clashed with creditors in the past few months. Just recently, he accused the European Union of terrorism by trying to scare the Greeks into voting the EU's way. Well, referendum results on Sunday show more than 61% of voters rebuffed warnings from European lenders that ignoring their calls for more austerity could force the country out of the 19-nation euro currency bloc. A Eurozone summit has been scheduled for Tuesday to discuss the matter. Shane Oliver, chief economist and head of investment strategy at the Sydney-based AMP Capital, told me he was surprised at the strength of the no vote, given how close opinion polls were going into Sunday's referendum. He says the country has entered uncharted territory in its future status with the 19-nation Eurozone.
The banking system will probably get a lot worse before it gets better, although there's nothing in the euro area rules to say that a country that's in default, as Greece now is, needs to leave the euro. The odds are that Greece probably will end up leaving the euro simply because it won't have enough money to make its government payments to support its banking system. It's really going to need its own currency because the ECB, the support of the European Central Bank, will soon be cut off. And so I guess the logic of it is, unless there's a renewed deal with the rest of Europe fairly soon, and it's unclear that there will be, then this has set Greece on a path to exiting the euro.
Eurozone nations are to hold a summit on Tuesday. What might they discuss?
I think European countries will discuss whether they should re-enter negotiations with Greece and what those negotiations might lead to. Obviously, those negotiations broke down over a week ago ahead of the referendum. And now, of course, whilst the Greeks are sort of saying that now they've got this no vote that will support their case against the creditors and lead to a better deal for Greece, the creditors, i.e. the European nations generally and, of course, the IMF, will probably stand fairly fast in terms of their requirements. So I think the European leaders will basically discuss what to do next, but it's not at all clear that they're going to want to enter into renewed negotiations with a government that they've found increasingly hard to deal with.
The commentators that I've heard indicate that Prime Minister Tsipras wants to remain in Europe, but not with the austerity measures that are expected to be imposed. Is that possible?
I think anything's possible here, and there's no doubt that the rest of Europe would prefer that Greece remains in the euro, but there's a price to be paid for that, and of course the rest of Europe doesn't want to be seen to be bending over backwards to Greece to allow them to stay without undertaking austerity, because that would send a wrong signal to other countries that might be vulnerable as well. So my feeling is that the Greek Prime Minister, to some degree, is being a bit disingenuous with his own population here. The population in Greece wants to stay in the euro. But, of course, to achieve that and to get support from the rest of Europe, they really need to show that they're keen on reforming their economy and undergoing the necessary austerity to cut back the size of government. But the no vote suggests that that's not the case. So, of course, it leads us with a bit of a standoff here. On the one hand, Greece hoping for another deal, but the Europeans probably likely to balk at that.
What is the future of the 19-nation Eurozone?
Well, I think the Eurozone still has a strong future. There's a strong political backing behind it. It's noteworthy that the Greek crisis has now been going for almost 6 years. It started back in November 2009 when the then new Greek government revealed that the previous government had understated Greek public debt, and that set off their crisis with intensifying periods in 2010, 11 and 12. Since then, of course, the Eurozone has actually grown in number from 17 to 19. And I think Greece's own actions have shown that it's the odd man out in Europe. It's the only country that's had intense difficulty in undergoing reform to put it onto a sustainable basis. Other countries, Portugal, Ireland, have all gone through difficult periods but seem to be weathering it reasonably well in the great scheme of things. And, of course, Spain, which was also seen as very vulnerable, has got its economy in much better shape, and all of these countries that were vulnerable have got their debt levels sort of under control and their budget deficits down. So it looks to me like Greece is the odd one out, and I think eventually that's the way financial markets will start to see it, as opposed to a situation where problems in Greece lead to problems in other countries. But the trouble is, in the short term, markets will be on edge. And, of course, we'll see further volatility and potential weakness in share markets over the course of the next few days.
And Oliver says, at least in the short term, life will become more difficult for the average Greek as the country lurches toward an ever more dysfunctional banking system and the economy sinks deeper into recession.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media about Greece. Andrew?
Well, we just were talking about Yanis Varoufakis, the finance minister, abruptly resigning this morning. And of course, since he's resigned, he's the top trending topic on social media. You have people saying it's time for him to go. It's a good thing that he's resigning. It'll help the country. Other people saying it's unfortunate because he was pushing for this no vote, and the no vote by 60 to 40 margin happened, but he's still resigning even after that result. And then you have the kind of silly people who are comparing him to Spock from Star Trek, saying there's a picture of him that looks like that and saying he's being beamed up out of office. Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter is another one because he's bald and they look somewhat similar. Certainly a trending topic, one with a lot of different opinions on this bailout and one that's sure to continue on social media in the coming days. He's kind of the focal point this morning, but there's sure to be other topics as they work through a deal.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Absolutely.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
When someone dies, one of the key questions medical examiners or forensics experts try to answer is the exact time of death. Sometimes the examiners, especially those involved in criminal investigation, need to determine the time of death of someone who has been deceased for a while. Unfortunately, current technology really doesn't provide any reliable way of determining time of death if the person has been dead for more than 36 hours. But a group of researchers at Austria's University of Salzburg say that they've developed a new method for calculating this, even if the subject has been dead for as long as 10 days. To develop the new calculation, the researchers studied dead pigs and observed how much muscle proteins and enzymes decomposed over a period of time. They found that some of the proteins showed no signs of degradation until after 10 days. By studying the appearance of these signs, the researchers were able to determine the exact time of death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The U.S. women's national soccer team has secured its third World Cup title with a 5-2 win over 2011 champions Japan in the title match in Vancouver, Canada. Carly Lloyd scored a 3-goal hat-trick in the opening 16 minutes to put the game out of reach of the Japanese, who beat the United States in the final 4 years ago. Hundreds of U.S. supporters gathered here in Washington to watch the final at a local bar, and VOA's Michael Lippin was with them. After the victory, he joined them for a celebratory march to the White House just a few blocks away, where he spoke to the head of the D.C. chapter of the American Outlaws, Donald Wine, and asked him how he was feeling.
It's awesome. Like, the women work so hard, and, you know, just to see the show of support that everybody's been, you know, giving them over the last month, over the last couple years, actually, has been great. And, you know, the fact that they're able to cap off a lot of these players, it's their last World Cup. And for them to go out on top, perfect.
And what do you think this means for soccer in America?
Well, it's just one more title we can hang over the rest of the world. Say, hey, look what we did in your own game. We got you. But yeah, I mean, it's great for the game. It's great for the women's sport, obviously. And I know they've gained a lot of new fans over this cycle, and that's awesome.
And what about the men? When is it going to be their turn, do you think?
Well, hopefully 2018. But you know, they're almost there. Like, we're, you know, one play away. If we get further than we were in the last tournament, 2014, which we did, you know, very good, who knows what we can do? I mean, with that American spirit, we can do anything.
My colleague also met up with two 26-year-old women who dressed to impress in the stars and stripes of the U.S. flag, Laura Neff from Los Angeles and Kali Westling from Wyoming. He first asked Laura what she thought about the support the U.S. women have been getting.
I think it's just awesome that people are coming out to support women's sports. You know, like, I feel like people are really excited about men's soccer, and last year everyone was, like, all about it, and... Yeah, I'm really, really proud of how much people supported. I was really disheartened at first because I felt like I didn't see as many people coming out for it, but they changed my mind by the end, and everyone's been cheering.
What do you think is in store for this sport in the country? Like, what about the men, for example? How do you think they're going to do going forward?
Well, so I was in Brazil last year for the World Cup, and yeah, it was heartbreaking seeing them lose, and I think that maybe having the women win this year, people are going to get more behind it and get more into soccer in general. I think that's where our country's headed, is getting more into soccer in general.
The men will get their chance to prove themselves in just 2 days from now when they start their campaign for the Gold Cup. That's the North and Central American Regional Tournament. Coming up on International Edition, just why do people love the Muppets? And a look at the life of a singing butterfly who got too close to the sun. The Muppets, those adorable puppets, are coming back to television on ABC this fall. They've made their way into people's hearts also on the big screen. Cartoonist Guy Gilchrist worked with puppet creator Jim Henson and joins us now on the line. Welcome, Guy.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. Nice to have you. Why do kids and adults alike so enjoy the Muppets?
You know, the Muppets are silliness and love, all wrapped up in music and very, very colorful personalities. You know, getting to work with Jim was one of the, you know, the greatest moments of my life. Certainly changed my life. But before I worked for Jim, I was about the biggest Muppet fan there was in the world. And so you can imagine what it was like, you know, to eventually get to work with him and work right beside him. But, you know, when you create characters of a nature that are so universal, you look at all of the emotions that those characters all represent. This is stuff that never, ever ages. And, you know, Jim was always very, very conscious, too, about making sure that the humor would be timeless and also universal, that the characters wouldn't be American, but they would belong to the world.
Well, the characters have evolved over the years. When they started out, they were pretty simple and pure.
Yeah, well, Jim was really an innovator, you know. But you know, he started off in the late 50s in the Washington, D.C. area doing a five-minute show between the end of the news and the Tonight Show called Sam and Friends that was local right in Washington, D.C. And at that time, you know, the puppets were simple hand puppets. But over the years, and my gosh, I got to see this, you know, on a daily basis, Jim would come up with new technology where the characters could, you know, walk on their own. They had electronics in them, all sorts of different things to just keep moving the art form forward.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, I remember one night Jim and I were having dinner at Maxwell's Plum in Central Park in New York City, and he was just back from working on The Great Muppet Caper. And if you remember in The Great Muppet Caper, there was a wonderful, wonderful scene where all of the characters are riding bikes, and you can see the choreography of the bikes in an aerial shot, in all kinds of different shots. And Jim took great delight that night in taking all the butter patties and the teacups and the salt and pepper shakers and moving them all around the table to illustrate how he did that and orchestrated that. And, oh, my gosh, I was laughing. And he was having so much fun explaining how the magic was being done.
He was a wonderful man. Well, what can we expect from the new TV show?
I think you're going to get I think what we're going to see is we're going to see the Muppets parodying the documentary and the reality show in pretty much exactly the same way that Jim and the Muppets parodied everything. Remember Veterinarians Hospital, you know, that was, of course, a parody of General Hospital and Pigs in Space. Who can't?
Yes, Pigs in Space.
The Muppets have always parodied everything. I'm kind of wondering if Miss Piggy's not going to be like, you know, on The Bachelorette or something.
Oh.
what would that be? The Baconette?
No.
Oh. Oh, I don't know. Sorry.
No.
Sorry. But I'm really not, because I worked for the Muppets, so, you know, puns are us.
Oh. Well, thank you so much, Guy, for chatting with us today.
Oh, it's been wonderful being with you, and I'll see you in the funny papers.
You're tuned to VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
British singer Amy Winehouse spanned less than a decade, and with her untimely death was seemingly over in the blink of an eye. Her entire life is chronicled in a new documentary film, as we hear from VOA's David Byrd, who gets things started with a Winehouse tune.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
Amy Winehouse died 4 years ago this month, but the new documentary Amy, by award-winning director Asif Kapadia, takes audiences behind the tragic story to meet the real Amy Winehouse. As he did with the acclaimed documentary Senna about the late Formula One champion Ayrton Senna, Kapadia uses no narration, only the words of the singer, her family, her friends, and those around her. Home videos, news reports, and performances show the singer from her childhood until her death at age 27.
I'm not a girl trying to be a star or trying to be anything other than a musician.
How big do you think you're going to be?
I don't think I'm going to be at all famous. I don't think I could handle it. I would probably go mad, you know what I mean? I would go mad.
Kapadia says the interviews with those around Winehouse paint a picture of a girl who loved making music, but was also deeply troubled.
I hope people will see the real Amy, as all of her friends called her, young Amy, really funny, really intelligent, bright-eyed, really beautiful and happy, amazingly creative. And then also, as the story gets darker, I hope people will kind of think about, you know, what happened and how it happened, and maybe a little bit about how I think everyone was slightly complicit.
Producer James Gay Rees says that as he and Kapadia researched the story, they began to unravel all the forces that tugged at Winehouse, and he thinks their portrayal of her shows the real woman.
And a lot of people who are very close to her say, you know, we have managed to kind of nail the real her. And that's the most important thing, is that people remember her for the lovely, brilliant person that she was, because she wasn't just some cartoon character that could be vilified in the press. And hopefully, I think what's happening is a lot of people are re-evaluating her. And, you know, because People like her didn't come around very often, and we need to look after them.
Several people featured in the film attended its premiere, including Winehouse's former manager, Nick Szymanski, who said the movie shows the singer's extraordinary talent.
She was able to kind of sing jazz, sing R&B, have a killer voice, but she also had like a really modern perspective on stuff. And lyrically, she was as witty and as sharp as the best hip-hop rappers, you know, in terms of her writing and her lyrical ability.
Her parents' divorce when Amy was 9 is cited as a turning point in her life. Winehouse's family, particularly her father Mitch, has criticized the film for being inaccurate.
And I'm not just fighting for me, I'm fighting for Amy, because this is not the film that Amy would have wanted. You know, she would want her true friends to be recognized, which they're not. She'd want the man that she was going to be married to be mentioned in the film, which he's not. She'd want me not to be portrayed in this light, because she knows what we all went through.
Asif Kapadia says that he has heard the family's criticism, but in the end, the film is not about them. It's about Amy.
No, you can't keep everybody happy. But what I will say is the vast majority of people who knew her well, who've seen the movie, really like it. And quite frankly, the movie's not about Reg, it's not about Mitch, it's about Amy. And I deny anybody to tell me that she doesn't come out of the movie brilliantly, because she does. She comes out of it fantastically. And it's a much more organic, whole representation of who she was.
Amy is rated R for language and drug material. I'm David Byrd.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In testimony before Congress regarding the state of democracy in Asia, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Tom Malinowski and Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Scott Marciel spoke of the crucial importance of promoting democracy and human rights. Helping to further democratic governance is not only the right thing to do, said Assistant Secretary of State Malinowski, it also advances our strategic interest by building more stable societies. And, most importantly, it aligns the United States with the aspirations of everyday people across this region. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Marciel highlighted U.S. efforts to promote democracy in 3 very different places, Cambodia, Thailand, and Hong Kong. After the 2013 parliamentary election in Cambodia, the United States, particularly through its embassy in Phnom Penh, worked to help bring the government and opposition together in direct dialogue to resolve a year-long standoff. Much work still remains, but now the two sides sit in parliament together, said Mr. Marciel. Regarding Cambodia's civil society, the United States is connecting directly with a new generation of leaders and standing with Cambodians who are pushing for a voice as new laws are drafted. This, he said, sends a reminder that democracy isn't only about free elections, it's also about citizens' ability to hold their governments accountable. Thailand has long been a friend and ally, and the United States has stood for democracy there through a decade of political turmoil. Our message to the government since the 2014 coup, said Mr. Marciel, is that our bilateral relationship can be restored to its fullest only when democracy is reestablished. It is critical for Thailand to have an inclusive political process and to fully restore civil liberties. Regarding Hong Kong, the United States has consistently voiced its core belief that an open society respecting the rights of its citizens is essential to Hong Kong's continued stability and prosperity. With respect to electoral reform, Mr. Marciel noted that the United States continues to affirm its long-standing position that the legitimacy of the chief executive and of Hong Kong's overall governance can be enhanced through a competitive election that features a meaningful choice of candidates who represent the will of the voters. The work to promote good governance is never complete, but the United States will continue to support efforts to build and strengthen democracy in Asia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.